on Friday, May 1st, 2009. Today, colleagues will be having an informational hearing on the flu that seems to be approaching our state, and we have a series of people who will be coming to talk with us about this. Dr. Bruce Goldberg, Dr. Mel Cohn, and whomever else you wish to bring up.
Dr. Ken Murphy.
And we have on the phone...
Kathleen O'Leary from Washington County Public Health.
Welcome, Kathleen.
Thank you.
And welcome, folks, this morning, and to all in the audience who have come. Go ahead.
Good morning. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bruce Goldberg. I'm the director of the Department of Human Services. I'm going to allow the other two gentlemen on my flanks to introduce themselves, and then I'll just make a couple of introductory comments.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the Acting Director of Public Health in the Public Health Division of the Department of Human Services.
Chair Tomei and committee members, for the record, my name is Ken Murphy. I'm the Director of Oregon Emergency Management, the Division of the Oregon Military Department.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, we're here this morning to do two things, to brief you on the current situation around swine flu nationally as well as here in Oregon, and then to talk a little bit about the statewide...
Dr. Goldberg, I'm going to stop for a minute. Would everybody please take out your cell phones and your blueberries and your blackberries and your raspberries and your strawberries and look at them? And make sure that they are turned off, not just on vibrate. They have to be turned completely off because it affects the sound system if it's on at all. So I appreciate doing that. Sorry to stop you, but I could hear it. Your voice was being distorted.
Oh, not a problem.
Thank you.
We're here to do two things this morning. One is to update you as to the situation regarding swine flu in the state of Oregon as it exists today, 8:30 Friday morning, and as well as to give you a sense of the state's preparedness and ability to deal with this as an issue as we move forward. I think as many of you may know, we now have four probable cases of swine flu here in Oregon. And this is a very rapidly changing national, international, as well as you can imagine, statewide situation. The state is responding aggressively and working to stay ahead of the outbreak. Our state and local public health officials, as well as state and local emergency management personnel, are working together and coordinating, and our goals in all of this are a couple. One is to contain and reduce the spread of illness, and the other is to reduce the severity of illness. We believe that we're likely to see more cases in the days ahead. And because of that, we continue to recommend three things to everybody in the state, which is really important. And this is the information that we're hoping to get to everybody in Oregon. And those three things are, first and foremost, people need to be diligent about washing their hands. Secondly, people need to be really careful about covering their nose and mouth when they cough and sneeze with something other than their hand, with a handkerchief, a tissue, to prevent the spread of germs throughout the community. And the third is to stay home and avoid contact with people if you're sick. That if individuals are ill, if they have fevers or coughs, the best thing to do is to remain home and not spread illness throughout the community. I know those things sound like the kinds of things that our parents told us from day one, and my mother, I'm sure right now, is saying, I told you so, and she's right. Most of my wisdom did indeed come from my mother, let the record show. But I think more importantly, those are that sounds like common sense information, and indeed in situations like this, it's the common sense, very practical kinds of things that we do and that we do as a state, which will really help us. So the message to everyone in Oregon is to really diligently try and follow those. And I believe that if everyone in the state can do those three simple things, and then we have an array of very talented experts in public health, in emergency management, both at the state and local level, that we will be able to contain and reduce the spread to the best of our ability. So with that, what I'd like to do is turn this over to Dr. Melcone, who is the head of public health and our state public health officer, to give you an update as to where we are as of this morning, and we can then take it from there.
Thank you, Dr. Goldberg.
Thank you, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. Once again, I'm Dr. Melcone, state health officer and acting director of the public health division at DHS. I really want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to have this hearing this morning, because one of the most important things we're trying to do to deal with this health threat is to provide information to people, and this is a great way for us to do that, both through this hearing and the information that all of you carry back to your constituents as well. So thank you very, very much for that. I'm going to start by telling you a little bit about swine flu and why we're concerned about this, and then talk about what's happening around the world and here in Oregon, and then close with some of the things that we have been working with partners around, because I think coordination is really the name of the game here, and I'm pleased to tell you that I think we're doing quite well in that department. So what is swine flu and why are we concerned about it? As everybody knows, we do have routine flu outbreaks every winter. We usually refer to that as seasonal influenza. And that is a serious disease. Every year in the United States, about 30 to 35,000 people die from this seasonal influenza. That works out to roughly 450 or so here in Oregon every year. And besides that, it's really pretty miserable. And anybody who's ever had the flu can tell you it's really not a pleasant experience. The best way to protect yourself against seasonal flu is to get a flu shot. And those shots are given starting in the fall and then throughout the rest of the flu season. But the issue with flu shots is that they have to be made up specifically for the strains that are likely to be circulating in the community in that year. And so every year, about February, the flu experts in the world look at the pattern of flu transmission around the world, what's circulating, what's out there, and they make some predictions about what's going to happen, and those are the components that go into that year's flu vaccine. They start in February. By the fall, those vaccines are delivered and they start to be administered. There are many different kinds and different strains of influenza. Broadly speaking, we have influenza A and influenza B. But even within influenza A and influenza B, there are strains that circulate in humans, and there are strains that circulate in other animals. The particular viral strains have properties that mean that, for example, avian flu is something that circulates among birds. Humans typically are not susceptible to those strains of the virus. However, flu viruses change, and they change sometimes very rapidly. And what's happened with this particular new strain of flu is that a swine flu strain has acquired some of the properties of a human flu strain, and in particular, the property that humans can not only get infected, but spread it to other humans. It's a little more complicated than that. There's actually a little bit of avian flu in this particular new strain as well. But as a shorthand, we'll call this this new swine flu strain. So what we have is a new virus that humans as a group, have not seen before. Our immune systems haven't seen before. We haven't been vaccinated against it before, and therefore we're susceptible. And this new strain also has the property that it can be transmitted from person to person. So that is why we're concerned about it. That is a potentially dangerous situation. When these major changes in flu virus occur in the past, they have led to very widespread epidemics, and the term that we use for that when it's a global phenomenon is a pandemic. So the concern that we have is that this, the appearance of this new virus is going to lead to a massive epidemic around the world. Okay. When we have these pandemics that have occurred in the past, how dangerous the virus is also varies quite a bit, and it's very, very difficult to predict. The 1918 pandemic was one that we were was very, very severe, many, many deaths, a lot of illness around the world. But we have had other pandemics since then that have been relatively mild, and in fact, you know, probably most people were even unaware that we might have had a pandemic. So the question is, if we have this new strain that has appeared, how dangerous is it going to be as this evolves? And let me say typically that the strain has arrived, it's here. We will probably see some illnesses, I expect, in Oregon in the next few days, few months, and so forth. Over the summer, I would expect that our flu activity is going to die down because that's what happens with flu. And then in the fall, we're going to be back into our regular flu season, except now we've got this new virus in the mix. So the potential for a pandemic, the concern is really what's going to happen as this plays out over the next couple of months. Well, how could you predict this? That's the question that flu experts have asked themselves for a long time. And it's very, very difficult. I'll tell you, flu is notoriously fickle. You think it's going to do one thing, and it does something else. The reason people have become so concerned were the initial reports that came out of Mexico that indicated not only widespread illness, but also a lot of people who died from this illness. By contrast, the way the virus has behaved up till this time in the United States has been really nothing very different from the seasonal flu that we see here. We have had, unfortunately, one death in a young child who had some other complicating medical conditions. I understand this was not here in Oregon. But all of the cases that have been confirmed around the U.S. have been much more on the milder end of the spectrum. There have been some hospitalizations, but people, for the most part, well, people have recovered and are doing okay. So that's the concern, and there's a lot of uncertainty about exactly what this is going to look like. But given the potential that this could be very serious, I think it's prudent for us to prepare, and I'm obviously not the only one who thinks it's prudent for us to prepare. We are following the guidance and advice of the best experts we can possibly find around the world on this issue. In Oregon here, Dr. Goldberg mentioned we have had four probable cases. We have not yet had a confirmed case. The reason for that is this strain is so new that our public health laboratory, like all the other public health laboratories around the country, did not have the ability to take the last step in the testing procedure and characterize it specifically as this new strain. But the way that the testing procedure works, I think of it as kind of an algorithm or a funnel, if you will. You start out with any virus you've gotten from somebody who has a respiratory illness, some of that is going to be flu, some of it isn't. Of the stuff that's flu, you characterize it, so on and so forth, and you end up with a relatively small number of influenza A isolates that are not typable using the current tools that we have, and I'll speak in a minute about, we will have those better tools very, very shortly. So of those non-typable influenza A isolates. We have had a handful of those. The four probable cases that Dr. Goldberg described are in that group. Those samples have been sent on to CDC, and we're awaiting the final characterization. But at least based on what we have heard from CDC about their laboratory testing, most of the samples they have received have turned out, in fact, to be this new strain of flu. And so we are treating these probable cases as very, very likely to be confirmed cases. And that means we have to assess each situation and respond, you know, as if they really are likely to be confirmed cases. Okay. In the Public Health Division, this has really been a very, very busy time for us, as you might imagine. Starting last weekend, we realized that this was, in fact, becoming more and more of an issue for us here in Oregon. We activated our agency operations center, and I'll tell you a little bit more about what that is and what it does for us in a second. And we've also been working with our emergency management colleagues to use the whole system that we have in place here in Oregon, should we need to use it. And I'm happy to say, if you will, to a certain extent, much of the resources that we need have been contained to our Public Health Division. But there have been specific things that we've been drawing on other agencies and our OEM colleagues to help provide. And it's really, really reassuring to me that we have those available should we need to draw on them in the future.
Dr. Cohen, I'm going to stop you for a minute. I have some questions to ask, and I assume other people in the committee might. So there are four probable cases in Oregon. So do we know anything about those cases? Were these people who had traveled in Mexico, or were they around other people who had come from Mexico?
Chair Tomei, all four of those cases are in the process of being investigated further. The first one that was the one that we announced in our press conference yesterday, we have the most information on. That was someone who had contact, we believe, with someone in Mexico who probably had this virus. The information on that, we're still trying to get additional information, but it appears to be the case. And it's the whole story is actually fits together pretty well and seems pretty logical that this person could have swine flu. The other three cases, I think, are at an earlier stage of investigation, and we have less information on, and I don't know actually where these people might have acquired their virus. I don't think we've gotten that yet from the investigation, but our local health department colleagues, and I know we have some of them here, and you'll hear from them in a minute, are the ones who will be on the ground doing those investigations, and I hope to have more information in the next couple of hours, day or two, as well.
Okay. Representative Callan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe just before we move on into what we're doing from here out, could we step back for just a second to the 1918 flu challenges? And I know that's what most of us have family stories about, the tragedies that were associated with that. Could you just do a very brief comparison then and now in terms of, we use the standard recommendation, again, what our mother taught us, rest in bed, drink plenty of fluids, and stay away from everybody else, and you'll get better. But for people who are seriously ill with the disease or need hospitalization, I am assuming there are other supportive medical interventions that take place, and maybe just a little comparative to what was available to those suffering from the disease in the early years.
Chair Tomei, Representative Callan, thank you for that question. It's a very important distinction to make, because I think we have a lot more resources and tools to help people when they become sick now than we did in 1918.
I would hope so.
But before I talk about the tools, let me talk a little bit about the population. You know, we in public health think about the population as a whole. And nutritionally, we are in much better shape than we were in 1918. We were coming out of World War I 1918, and all of the stress and strain that that put on our population affected people's health. So we're in a very different place now. I don't mean to say that we don't have challenges and stresses in our lives. Of course we do. But from a population perspective, I think that that is very, very helpful for us now. In addition, although we don't yet have a vaccine against this new strain, I'm hopeful that we will at some point in the fall have a vaccine supply that will be helpful. We did not have that in 1918. We also have antiviral medications, which I want to say this very clearly, have fairly limited use in these kinds of situations, but very important use. One of the places that their use, I think, is quite important is for people who are very critically ill, and this can be something that really can be life-saving in that setting. So we have that, and of course all of the other advances in medical care that we have, for example, ventilators for people who are having trouble breathing, IV fluids, all of the more general kinds of supportive measures that our medical care system can put in place. I think those things will make a huge difference if we get to the point where we're dealing with a very dangerous virus that's very widespread later in the course of this whole event.
Let me follow up. Thank you very much. I'm sure we'll get to the discussion of the antivirals later, but I really wanted to focus a little bit on just the general supportive nature of what we have in medical. I can't even say it now. And, yeah, I know what I'm trying to say. The interventions that are available in this century, I guess, is. I appreciate that. Thank you.
I have a question, too. How virulent is this virus? I mean, it sounds like some people have become ill, but some people have been able to stay home. They haven't had to go to the hospital. One child we know in the United States died, if I remember correctly. But it sounds like other people have not gotten such a serious reaction to the virus. Is that true?
Chair Tomei, that is true. Although, again, we've got this kind of Two pictures of what's happening with this virus. One is what we heard was happening in Mexico, what we've been hearing is happening in Mexico, that does appear to be quite virulent, quite severe. On the other hand, our experience in the United States has been very, very different. Now, the question is, why is there that difference? We don't have an answer to that yet, although that is being actively investigated. There are people from the Centers for Disease Control and the World Health Organization on the ground in Mexico trying to look at that. And some of the hypotheses that they have had, first of all, is there a slightly different strain of the virus in Mexico than is here? I remember I told you flu virus evolves. It changes very rapidly. No evidence that that's the case so far, although I don't think we've fully investigated that yet. Could it be that there's some other cofactors that are present in some group of people in Mexico that have led them to become much more seriously ill that, for whatever reason, the people who've been exposed here don't have? Again, don't have anything more concrete than to say some cofactor as a hypothesis. So that, I think, is actively being investigated. And I guess the third line of reasoning that I think is probably going to be the most likely explanation is that when you look at the number of people who have died, you also need to look at that in the context of the number of people who have been infected. If I told you that we had 500 people infected and 250 of them died, that's an extraordinarily high death rate. On the other hand, if I told you that we had 50 million people infected and 250 of them died, it's a very, very different kind of situation. And remember, I told you that deaths do occur from flu. So the death rate is not going to be zero. So one of the hypotheses about what's happening in Mexico is that there are many, many more people who are infected, and that the high number of deaths we're seeing is high simply because of that, rather than that the virus is more virulent.
I see. Thank you.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. Now, having on my third round of what we endearingly refer to as the capital crud since February, that's one of the questions I have, is relative to And I would like to suggest that before we begin session that we all get vaccinated so that we have this huge mobilization in the Capitol so we don't all get sick again. So is that possible? It sounds like to me that at this point we can't do that because we don't have a vaccine that fits this particular virus. But if that's so, if there's something by fall, are there plans to, you know, mobilize us? And because I recall when I was a kid standing in line and getting my shots because something was going on. Is that possible, or is that something planned, or are we still thinking?
Representative Van Orman, Representative Tomei, I think that's an excellent point, and you're absolutely right. We do not yet have a vaccine. One of the things we've been doing over the last few years is preparing for the possibility of a pandemic, as well as a variety of other health threats. And one of the capabilities we have been figuring out how to do, not just in the Capitol, but in all of our communities, and this is really, local public health has done a terrific job of doing this, is to figure out if we had to vaccinate a large number of people, how would we do that? The logistics involved are actually quite complicated. And of course, they really are a local issue. I mean, if you ask me where in Joseph, Oregon, we should set up a station to vaccinate people and where I should get people who could administer that vaccination, I couldn't possibly tell you. But I guarantee you that the person from the Wallowa County Health Department not only can tell you that, but has thought that through, perhaps even exercised components of that plan. And so we'll be ready to go when we have the tools to do that. We don't, as far as I know, have a specific plan for immunizing legislators, but I'm happy to arrange that when we have vaccine. I can't promise you something I don't have yet.
Follow up? I just want to say we've all gotten it.
No, we haven't.
Oh. Well, there are other, not just legislators get this.
Representative Van Orman, Chair Tomei, the one follow-up I would have is the simple prevention messages, the common sense things that Dr. Goldberg talked about apply to all of us. So wash your hands. If you're ill, stay home and don't spread this illness to other people, and cover your mouth and your nose if you're coughing and sneezing with something other than your hand, so that, again, you're not spreading virus out to others.
And could you demonstrate that, how to cover up your mouth and nose without using your hand?
Okay, so handkerchief or tissue works perfectly well. Very good. But in the absence of that, this kind of thing is better than this.
Thank you.
Chair Tomei and Representative Van Orman, members of the committee, I think part of the answer to your question about our ability as a state, what I think is important for the legislature to know, and perhaps can be covered in a little bit, is that we have a system in this state with state and local public health, with the medical community, and with our emergency management system. We have a statewide pandemic flu plan, which is available. We can share that with you, and that we have been practicing and exercising that as a state as well. And so we have a plan. We've been practicing it. And if and when we need, if a vaccine becomes available and we need to do that as a state, we feel that we will be ready to activate that plan and be able to distribute the vaccine and get it to people in a way that makes sense.
Thank you. And I think we're going to move on because I think there are several people who want to speak, and I didn't mean to interrupt you in the middle of your talk, Dr. Cohn. Did you have anything more to add?
I think the only other thing I would say is that this is a situation that's changing rapidly, and that is an anxiety-producing kind of place for all of us to be. I recognize that, and I feel some of that myself. But I can tell you that I've been very, very reassured by the kind of response that we've gotten from all of our partners, and I really feel that things are working quite well, activating the parts of the plan that we've had to activate to date, and we're working very, very hard and very well together.
Great. Great. Glad to hear that. Thank you.
Madam Chair, before I want to ensure, because of the level we are at the legislature, at the state level, that we're going to address issues of command and control, some of this leadership issue that you folks are, you know, directly involved with. Is that part of your presentation?
Representative Tomei, Representative Maurer, I can speak now if you'd like about how we're organizing that. Would that?
It's fine. I don't. Whatever you want to do, but I think someone needs to address it.
Okay. So typically, when we have an emergency of this kind, we move into a mode of operating called incident command. And this is actually a methodology that was developed to deal with wildfires where you had many agencies involved and you had to figure out who was just making the decisions, who had the authority to do that, and also how did you pull in and coordinate all of the different resources that are needed to do that. So that's the overall structure that we're using. And the way that plays out on the ground is that we have our agency operations center, which has been up and running since Monday morning. We were sort of partially activated last weekend, but we've really been running very, very vigorously since Monday. We have kind of a war room, if you will, within the health department, and the job of this group is to ensure that we are pulling in all of the resources we need appropriately and that the decisions are being made and vetted appropriately. If we need something that is outside of the capability of what we already have at the health department on hand, and I should say also, this is not just the health department that's activated. All of our local health department partners are similarly working in parallel structures that feed into this whole emergency management system. If we need to go above the capabilities of the state health department, the next place we turn is the Office of Emergency Management. They are the conduit, if you will, for any requests or assistance that we need from other agencies or from other parts of the federal government other than the health agency that we work with most directly. So that's, again, a communication and coordination function. Our federal partners have been very, very important in this as well. President Obama has declared a public health emergency, I believe that happened last Sunday, and has authorized the release of 25% of Oregon's allotment of the Strategic National Stockpile, which is a cache of medical supplies, in this case, antiviral medication and some personal protective equipment like masks and gloves and so forth. He has authorized each state to be able to draw down 25% of what's been allotted. It's allotted based on population. We have requested those supplies, and we're expecting them to arrive on Saturday night. The date has been changing a little bit, but that's the latest information that I have on when it's going to arrive. I should say we're not planning on deploying that right now, but it's reassuring to have it here on the ground. It's one less logistical challenge for us to cover. Does that speak to your question, Representative Maurer?
Actually, it's about the relationship between you and the governor. And last session, we made a change in the whole issue of the quarantine laws, and we're not there yet. But just who is the state's public health officer? Who has the authority to quarantine? Western Oregon closed today. A one-day closure, in my mind, is doesn't cut the mustard if you're going to close something. I'm not sure the rationale behind the closure. Did you recommend a closure? And because, you know, we can talk about how to prevent it in another forum. This is a forum at the 50,000-foot level. We're talking about issues of state government and that interrelationship between the feds. So I'll just let you answer those multiple questions if you could.
Okay. Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, I am the state public health officer. The bill that you passed last session does give the governor the authority to give me all of those authorities if that's necessary. And in addition, the governor has the authority to declare an emergency, and that would provide him all kinds of appropriate powers that might be needed to control an emergency. That's not just a public health emergency, but all kinds of emergencies. So those authorities exist. They are there. We're aware of them. And if they're needed, we will exercise them. I have absolutely no problem with doing that if it's needed. And that's the rub right there. With respect to Western Oregon, and I know that we have the president here. If you need more information than I'm able to give you, because I can tell you about the public health side of it, I'm not an expert on that particular university. One of the probable cases that we had is a student at Western Oregon. And when we did our preliminary investigation, and I really have to say the folks from Polk County Public Health, who are not here today because they're getting ready to have a press conference about this later this morning, have done an absolutely astounding job. The information that we got in the matter of just a few hours, I was just really, really impressed with. But what that information told us was that we had somebody who was a probable case, which meant that probably he was going to be confirmed as a case, who had symptoms and was infectious and potentially had contact with a large number of students on campus. And on top of that, the university had some events that were planned for this weekend. I believe it was 1,500 athletes that were expected to come from all over the state to Western. I think there was a group of third graders who were also going to come. And then, of course, they come for the day, have their event, and then they go back to their communities. So we've got two possibilities here. The first is this guy is not infectious with swine flu. He doesn't have swine flu, and we probably shouldn't do anything about this. The second is we've got somebody who it sounds pretty likely that he's going to have swine flu, and we're bringing a whole bunch of people in to a place where many people may have been exposed, and then we're going to send them all back to their communities where they're going to seed their communities with this virus. So there's some uncertainty there, but I would tell you that that latter scenario is not one that I would want to have happen. So the university called us. We had a consultation about this. They asked us, what do you think? We talked through this whole scenario with the local public health colleagues, and I said to the folks from the university, my recommendation is that you close the school at least until Monday. And the reason I say until Monday, so this was not a one-day closure, the reason I say until Monday is because I hope by Monday we will have confirmation of whether or not this is a swine flu case or not. If it turns out it's not, then we will open and go back to normal. If it turns out that it is, then we probably will extend the closure for 3 more days. This kind of closure is not going to completely stop this disease from spreading to anybody. I think that's essentially an impossible thing to do at this point. What it will do is slow the spread of the disease, however, throughout the community there in Monmouth and into other communities throughout the state. And that really was the goal, to try to protect health and safety. So we didn't order the school to close. We didn't have to do that. They said, what should we do? We told them what we thought they should do, and they said, we're there. And rapidly, I mean, it was amazing. We had this discussion, I think, about 6 o'clock last night. By, I think, about 8 o'clock or so, this was out on the wires. They had started notifying parents, and everything had moved forward. So that's kind of how that whole scenario played out.
Thank you. I appreciate the answer and your candor in that. And just so you know, Dr. Cohen, I have great confidence in your abilities. That's one of the parts of the Department of Human Services that I think that we do really well in the state of Oregon is this whole issue of dealing with emergencies, and so I give you a lot of credit, and so hopefully we go forward and that is, you know, continued. It's a difficult issue to deal with. I think that it, quite the avian flu, kind of the scare, really woke some people up, and we had a chance several years ago to prepare some plans that maybe weren't as vetted, and so we hopefully this isn't that bad, as bad as everybody thinks it could be, but it also gives you it's another opportunity to dust off the plan and actually implement pieces of it and refine that going forward.
May I, Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, just add one thing to my description of how this all played out. As we had this discussion, we had extensive consultation with Dr. Goldberg. We talked with the governor's office. This was vetted all the way up the line. So I wanted to make sure that, you know, this wasn't just me acting either on my own or willy-nilly. This really, we drew on all of the expertise and wisdom we could as to what was the right thing to do in this particular situation.
More importantly, our system is working, and just one follow-up on the Western Oregon University system. For the legislature, which I think is important, we, you know, last night we were rapidly in touch with Western Oregon. We've also been in touch with the entire Oregon University system, and with the chancellor, we this morning are having are getting together with all of the state university health personnel and administrative personnel, as well as the county public health personnel from the counties in which each of those universities are in, so that we can walk through A, what's happened at Western, and B, talk about how we would respond in case there are other cases that happen at the university system. So we're bringing together and trying to get ahead of being able to bring together the decision makers and, in essence, activate the system that we've got to be able to coordinate and stay ahead of this.
There are a couple of legislators in the audience, several, and I just want to make sure that you realize that you're welcome to come up and join us up here if you desire to, and so that you can ask questions. And I want to welcome Senator Lori Mona Sanderson.
And could I make a comment?
Of course.
I think that having been a public health nurse for most of my professional life, we public health nurses are sort of the silent entity, and we are having outbreaks all the time, and we are there with whether it's Giardia or Salmonella or TB. We are doing this all of the time, and yet public health, sorry to put this statement in, is one of the first things that we don't fund. Just a comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Callan, then we're going to move on.
Yes, well, and I know that we do need to move on. Madam Chair, some of the members of our House Veterans and Emergency Services Committee are joining us today, too, and I just want to make it clear that the committee stands prepared as if this moves forward and we need to have further conversation about the mobilization and the emergency operation needs. We can certainly carry that conversation on as well, but I very much appreciate the good senator's conversation about public health, because the comment that Polk County public health folks weren't able to be here this morning because they're preparing for their own news conversation. This is a challenging subject for the media to cover thoroughly and well and get the quality of the information that we're hearing here today out to the general public, that there are some unique aspects, for example, of the Western Oregon decision around closure because of the number of people that were expected on campus and those sorts of things that need to be fully vetted. It puts a huge challenge to our local public health officials as they try to deal with some of those specifics, and we need to recognize that in this conversation. Most of our local public health departments aren't well enough staffed to have people to simply dedicate this to this issue without taking them away from all of their other everyday jobs. And so I want to make sure that we recognize the challenges in each of our communities. We have people there ready to do what we need to do, but it isn't without a significant cost in our communities. Thank you for letting me vent a bit.
You're welcome, Representative.
Representative Boone, then we're going to
thank you, Madam Chair. And I heard Dr. Goldberg almost say the rest of it. I was going to ask about the other schools in the university system, but don't forget the community colleges. There's 17 more to deal with, so thank you.
Thank you. We will.
Okay. Were you finished, Dr. Cohn?
I think so. Certainly I'll be here, and if there are other issues or questions that come up, I will be happy to answer them.
Terrific. And Mr. Murphy.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. I'll be brief and just say that, as you've heard described by Dr. Goldberg and Dr. Cohen, our role in emergency management is to support the Department of Human Services and the Public Health Division. They have the lead. Our office has been intimately involved for at least 3 years in working on this pandemic influenza plan that the Public Health Division has written. And I can validate what Dr. Goldberg said. We have tested it many times at the state level and at the county level. And so I think it's a good plan. It addresses pretty much just about all you can imagine in how we have to deal with these situations. So I bring to bear and support the Public Health and Department of Human Services with the other assets that state agencies bring to bear and what the governor's office may ask. As they've discussed with the delivery of the strategic national stockpile, that's been in coordination with the Oregon Military Department, the Oregon State Police, and the Oregon Department of Transportation, and so working collaboratively to position that and make sure that goes smoothly and that it's properly cared for and secured. We're also in the emergency management arena making sure that our county emergency managers and city emergency managers are working closely with their public health counterparts at the local level. And as we speak now, the Public Health Division is conducting a conference call with all the county emergency managers to make sure that they're educated on this subject. As you can well imagine, the emergency managers are used to seeing floods and snow and rain and buildings falling down. So this sometimes is a little bit scary because you have none of those things, and so we're trying to make sure that they realize what is happening and what's there. Also, we are taking numerous conference calls from the Department of Homeland Security and the Federal Department of Health and Human Services from a national level that our office and the Public Health Division share. To make sure that we have a national perspective. My office is also talking to our neighboring states in collaboration just to see what they're doing, how they're handling it, making sure that we can share resources if needed. Because in these type of events, because of the potential travel issues and spreading the disease, a lot of times you cannot get those things from other states or other entities that we may be normally accustomed to through the Emergency Management Assistance Compact. Also, we have a member of Oregon Emergency Management in the Public Health Agency Operations Center liaisoning with them, and we're working up our staffing patterns and contacting other state agencies. Our State Emergency Coordination Center is monitoring this and taking calls from counties to answer questions and preparing the possibility if we do have to go 24/7, to deal with this. And so we'll be supporting the public health with all of their needs and cases, primarily in logistics, but anything else. If, as you can well imagine, they're probably getting tired. They've been working very hard, and so if they need additional staff, we can help try and facilitate that. I think other than that, good situational awareness from our office in coordination with public health so we know what's going on. It's a fast-moving situation as things develop, so we will support public health and the Department of Human Services any way we can. And finally, the governor and the adjutant general, who is our Homeland Security Advisor, are having a conference call today with Secretary Napolitano and Secretary Celebus, the new Department of Health and Human Services Secretary, to give updates. And then we will also be operating this weekend at the State Emergency Coordination Center to act upon any support and also make sure that the delivery of the strategic national stockpile materials happens as planned. So I will leave it at that, and if there is any questions, I can answer.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Murphy or Dr. Cohen, this would be for you. And I just kind of want to get back to a question. You talked about your ICS command center that you've opened up. Have you established an access number yet for the public, or are you waiting for that?
Thank you.
Chair Tomei, Representative Olson, funny you should ask that. Dr. Goldberg was just asking me what the number was, and I didn't have it in my head. So, you know, probably the biggest challenge we've had here is getting information out to the public, out to the media, out to everybody who wants to know, particularly when things are changing. So we do have a toll-free hotline number, and the number is 1-800-978-3040. Actually, there's a story with the hotline that I think really illustrates the way that people have been pitching in around this. We were having trouble ramping this up at first because we had fairly limited capacity in our building, just the wiring and so forth. Excuse me. And so what happened was that we said, who else has this kind of capability? And as it turns out, the Oregon Poison Center fields these kinds of calls. They have a lot of infrastructure. And they said, well, maybe we can help you out with that. And so that is, in fact, exactly what we're going to be doing with the hotline to increase our ability to handle calls. We also have set up a website, www.flu.oregon.gov, that is a place where we are posting all of this information, any advisories we're putting out, the latest case counts, all of this kind of stuff. That's a great place to look as well. Thank you.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. In listening to what you've had to say, having been a Head Start director for 22 years, I can tell you that out of a four-hour class day, 1 hour was at least in hand washing. But one of the concerns I have is the low-income working poor, because the kids had to come to school because they had no other resource, and the parents had to continue working because if they didn't work, there was no income. So one of the concerns I have as we're talking is, how do we reach those low-income families that may not be necessarily in an identifiable group? And I'm thinking, so anyway, I just thought about that, and I guess I'm going to be calling my Head Start people.
Representative Van Orman, Chair Tomei, that is a real concern. I think we're telling people, for example, stay home and don't go to work if you're sick. Well, what if you have to go to work or you're going to lose your job? That's a very, very difficult situation for people to be in. I think there are questions about access to health care that this whole situation bears on as well. And you all know that is a big problem that you all are in the midst of grappling with. It's a very difficult issue. My hope is that to the extent that we can, when things really get going, and again, I'm thinking that if this continues, the fall is going to be when we are really going to have a lot of these issues in a widespread way, that there can be some planning and some thinking about this in advance, so that whatever arrangements need to be made, whatever other kinds of services can be offered, that's going to happen. I don't have an easy solution for those. They're much larger problems than just the swine flu problem.
Follow up. We're going to move on.
Okay.
Sorry. So I think you might have some other people that you would like to have.
Yeah, I was going to certainly step down, and I think it was an important part of this morning was to not only update you about where we are, what swine flu is, and where we are as a state, but to also talk a little bit about the network that we have and our ability to respond. You've heard about some things on the statewide level, and we have some folks from the local county public health departments that I think would be important to hear about the kinds of things that are being done at the local level and how we all coordinate. So I'm going to step down and Ken is going to step down.
And before you do step down, I guess one of the things I want us all to be thinking about, in some ways this may not be the pandemic that we've sort of been thinking about for some years. Hopefully it won't be. But someday there will be that pandemic. And at some point we need to look at that, how prepared we are for that that very destructive, awful pandemic that we won't be prepared for, that will happen in the fall. This happening in the spring is probably good timing in the sense that people will not be in enclosed sections for very long. But when it happens in the fall, we're not prepared for that. It can be a much more destructive pandemic. So at some point, maybe not today, but we need to address that. How prepared are we for the one that will be a very consuming pandemic? Thank you all for coming here. Thank you.
Madam Chair, while they're changing out, the 1918 pandemic, in fact, lasted. It wasn't just a one wave. It was multiple waves.
Right.
And it went from one flu season to the next flu season.
And with transportation the way it is, with people being able to readily come from one country to another within hours, it seems to me that we have some added dangers that we might not have had in 1918. So, Kathleen, I think you're from Washington County Public Health. Do you want to start this out?
I would. Chair Tomei, committee members, for the record, my name is Kathleen O'Leary. I'm the Public Health Administrator from Washington County Public Health and the Chair of the Conference of Local Health Officials. Because of the level of activity around swine flu here in Washington County, when I conclude speaking and addressing any questions that you might have for me specifically, I will be disconnecting and returning to those activities. I'm grateful to Dr. Goldberg and Dr. Cohen, and certainly concur with them that the public health system in Oregon, state and local, is working in a very integrated and coordinated fashion. Local public health is well connected to our community, to our healthcare providers, to our hospital systems, to our community groups, to our educational folks, and we are coordinating the information that we have, the situational awareness that we have at the local level with our state partners, and it is gratifying to see the system work as intended. As you've heard, we've been planning over the last several years around influenza and pandemic influenza, and that's been at the state level, but also at the local levels. So each county, in fact, does have a local pandemic plan, and we are now in the process of beginning to implement the beginning stages in those plans and working with our local partners around that. This particular outbreak really is our number one priority, and we've activated our public health command systems here. We're well connected to our county emergency managers. We're beginning to pull in staff from our other public health programs so that we can focus our time and our attention on this outbreak in order to protect the public's health. Thank you, Senator Mona Anderson. Yes, our local public health nurses really are the front line, working to investigate suspect, probable, and eventually confirmed cases of this flu. As you've heard, these investigations tell us an awful lot about what's going on, who the cases are, who are the possible contacts, who else might have been exposed, and that allows us locally, and because this information is reported to state public health across the state, to come up with measures to contain and decrease the spread of this infection. While there's very clear state and local roles here in the metro area, because of the planning that we've been doing with our hospital preparedness organization, really identified the need for a regional approach for something such as pandemic influenza. The hospital systems cross county borders, ESDs cross county borders, big employers cross county borders, and one of the things that we heard very clearly in planning early on, particularly from our hospital system partners, was we need a sense of what's going on in the region. We need that situational awareness across the region so that we're operating on the same information, that we're able to plan together, that we reduce the workload for our partners who cross county borders to not have to connect independently with each county in order to get a sense of what's going on, that there would be a regional component for that situational awareness. April 29th, we actually started what we are referring to as our Regional Health and Medical Coordinating Center. And this includes Clackamas, Washington, Multnomah, Columbia, and Tillamook and Clark counties. So this, with representatives from those counties, we're able to get a metro picture of what's going on, which includes Southwest Washington, to be able to report back to each of the county health departments, to be able to report to the state, and able to report to our integrated partners to have a clear picture of what's going on here regionally as well as within specific counties. My colleague Jenny Leonard from Umatilla County is there with you today, and she's going to speak more around local response and preparedness. But if you have any questions for me specifically before I leave, I would be happy to take those.
Any quick questions for Ms. O'Leary? Seeing none, thank you so much for joining us. Why don't you stay on if you can, and we'll hear from Ms. Linhart.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chair Tomei and committee members. As Kathleen said, I'm Jenny Leonard. I'm from Umatilla County, and I'm the administrator of that county health department. I really appreciate the opportunity to come again and visit with you about H1N1 and how the local response is taking effect in our counties across the state. On Saturday, the 25th, I was given the opportunity to provide testimony to the Ways and Means Committee. And at that committee, I used the analogy that public health was the invisible soldiers or the invisible armies here in Oregon. And little did I know that 2 days later, I would be calling upon our soldiers locally to respond to this public health event. So it was very time appropriate that I happened to throw that analogy out on that very day. Responding to public health emergencies is our number one priority, and it is what we do best. Local public health is playing a vital role in the response to the H1N1 outbreaks. Locals know their communities, and we have plans in place, and we've exercised those plans. We're working closely with the state, and we provide consistent and accurate, up-to-date information as it's available to us. So what does the response to H1N1 look like locally? You've heard from Dr. Cohen and from Kathleen both about how we're all coordinating our efforts, but I wanted to talk to you about the two integral parts in providing a strong local response. Those are surveillance and public health information. These two go hand in hand, really. Initially, locals must make a call to actions to all of our partners and our medical providers within our communities when we have a public health emergency or event. Through our previous planning and exercisings, we've created these relationships in which we have clearly identified the roles and the expectations of public health in our community. We've already had the conversations that are necessary to be able to work with our medical providers. Might I say, work with them and not against them. They know and they see us as a partner and not a hindrance in this process. We work very hard and diligently to keep them informed and apprised on the best testing measures, the cases, and the most up-to-date recommendations from both the CDC and the state. This is important because it keeps our providers within the loop, and additionally, it allows them more time with their clients or their patients and less time trying to navigate the system to find the information that we already have available to us. Our emergency response plans have allowed us to identify all the community players. This is important because in the event of public health emergencies that we're seeing today, we need to have already previously identified these players and already developed the communications needed to know who's doing what, when, and where. I mentioned earlier that we rely on our medical providers for our surveillance. Additionally, we're in close contact with our schools and ESD. These are the folks that have the pulse on what our children are doing. In the event of a school closure, public health works with the schools, providing support and assistance in making the next step directions. EMS is an essential surveillance tool that we also work closely with. These individuals are...
Have to tell us what EMS is.
Emergency Medical Services, sorry. These are the folks that are responding to our everyday medical emergencies, so it's imperative that we're involved with them and know what they're doing as they know what we do. Police, tribes, fire, churches, Salvation Armies, daycares, schools, and the media. All of these partners are involved in an effective public health response. Public health nurses are instrumental in the surveillance process. They work within the communities to monitor disease and perform on-the-ground investigations in the event that we have outbreaks. It's imperative that we're providing accurate and frequent information to our residents and to our community partners. Working in rural Oregon doesn't remove the importance of knowing and utilizing the media. This is my number one source for pushing out information. I've spent years cultivating these relationships, and it has served me well and is currently serving me very well. On average, we're releasing a press release every 1 to 2 days out locally in Umatilla County.
On this issue?
On this very issue. I'm speaking daily with print, radio, and TV. We've utilized these folks to provide information to our residents on preventative measures, testing guidelines, and cases. Additionally, I'm in close contact with my county commissioners, providing them frequent updates about surveillance and the public health information that we're sending out to our residents. We utilize blast faxing to all of our partners. Those would be our medical folks, our emergency medical providers, schools, our emergency manager, tribes, neighboring counties, hospitals, and bordering states. We also are in phone contact with our neighboring counties on a daily basis, as well as fielding many, many, many calls from residents. I already mentioned that responding to public health emergencies is our number one priority. We do, this is where we do our best work. My staff, who all have other public health jobs, or their day jobs, have been cross-trained to respond quickly and effectively in the event of a public health emergency. They can and have rapidly shifted directions, as we have needed them to do, to become our effective soldiers to respond. Everyone in my department is cross-trained in the incident command system. My county department, as all county health departments, have spent years building and strengthening local staffing and infrastructure to be able to respond effectively and efficiently. Umatilla County Emergency Operations Center is on stand and ready to go into active mode when and if we have a case and need to call them up to duty. We work very closely with our emergency managers. We have an outstanding EOC, Emergency Operations Center, and have utilized it in previous exercises, so we're aware of how to call that facility up to our needs. I think what's mostly important, and the point that I'm trying to make, is that public health doesn't work in a box. We rely heavily on our strong partnerships that we have taken years to cultivate and grow. We're only as good or as strong as our weakest link, so it's imperative that we have spent the time making sure all of our links are hearty.
I'm going to ask you a question about that. It's interesting you use that analogy, because I was wondering, and I would like to ask that of both Ms. O'Leary and you. So what would be the weakest link? What keeps you awake at night, worrying that if there were an emergency, what might you not be able to respond to? What would be the weakest link?
I worry mostly about communications and being effective. I think not knowing is probably the scariest piece for our residents in any state or county. I worry mostly about communication. I also worry additionally about those folks that, like we had talked earlier, we can't access, Head Start people, families, those that attend or don't really necessarily have their pulse on our means of communication. We work really diligently to make sure that we're covering it across the board. But, you know, probably, you know, 30% of our residents don't take the newspaper. Maybe they don't listen to the radio. Maybe they're not watching our TV, our local TV. How are we reaching them? We had the opportunity to exercise that when we had a major windstorm in Milton Freewater, Oregon, and trying to get in touch with those isolated individuals, the ones that aren't hearing and knowing what's happening. Those are the ones that make me the most nervous.
Now, I would ask the same thing of you. What's the weakest link in the state?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I think with respect to the local health departments, it's a capacity issue, mostly. You know, we have a recent assessment done by our Conference of Local Health Officials that looked at our health department capacity in 10 key areas and showed some very significant gaps. And this is a result of the kind of process that Senator Mona Sanderson referred to earlier. To me, that is the biggest issue with respect to emergency response that we face. Those folks in the county health departments are our front line, and we need to make sure we have them there with the skills we need.
Madam Chair, I've got a couple of here, and then I'll get back to Senator Mona Sanderson.
When you asked that question, I was thinking staffing. When we have an outbreak, it's scary, because especially when you're going into the a daycare and you are interviewing all these patients, or not the kids, but the parents and the staff, and there's only so many of us that can really do all of the work that we need to try to cut down the spread. So that's the scary thing if we really do have a pandemic, because we're so understaffed as it is, and then to have to come up, but we're willing to work long, they are really willing to work long and heavy hours, but it gets a little scary. To me, that would be very scary if we really had a true disaster or outbreak. We wouldn't have the capacity.
I agree with you, and it's the kind of thing that keeps me up waking at night. And to me, this is a wake-up call about how important public health is. And as we look at our budget in this legislative session, it seems to me that that's something we need to keep in the forefront. Representative Boone, then Representative
On the coast, in the coastal communities, we have developed a pretty simple system of alerting people for tsunami preparedness and earthquake preparedness, and it's basically a door-to-door, neighbor-to-neighbor thing, and people are assigned I'll just make something up, a four-block area, and they literally own this block, and or this block of homes, and they go door-to-door, and they tell people, I'm your block person or whatever, and they identify more and more volunteers so that everybody has, especially the people who are maybe have some issues with health and can't get out quickly and do take care of themselves as well. But it's very successful. They drill a couple times a year on it, and we just had one in the Seaside area, and it's every time they do it, they pick up more and more people, and they've licensed a lot of ham radio operators, etc. But it might be something that you could do on the east side. That could be your tsunami, you know, some health care issues. But it's very easy, it's very cheap.
Thank you, Representative Boone. Mm-hmm. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jenny, I thank you so much for the presentation that you gave, and I'm hoping that you, because you were reading from notes, you could perhaps at some point give us copies of that, because seriously, it was a very comprehensive look at our local public health departments, where we are right now. I go back probably a little bit too far in some of the issues that have come along, but in our early years in Lincoln County, and my spouse being involved with the school district, there was a unexpected measles outbreak when an exchange student arrived from another country bearing measles for our community, and it was incredibly frustrating to the school district people, because every time they felt at that point that every time they called public health, they got a different answer. The coordination and communication has come a very long way in the last 20 years or so. And I remember during the anthrax times, my local public health people talking about how much of their time they spent with their little things of talcum powder demonstrating what aerosol spread of anthrax versus just hearing about it meant. Those are the kinds of education pieces that get down to the what you and I need to know about protecting ourselves and washing our hands, and is hand sanitizer a good thing to use if you can't, and some of those kinds of things. So the amount of work that you've done and the communications that have been improved within our local public health delivery system and our relationship with the whole spectrum of emergency preparedness, and we have now finally figured out this mindset to bring public health into emergency responses as well. I really needed for just a moment to highlight that we've come a very long way. Mm-hmm. Whether we're fully and totally, completely prepared to take care of whatever may roll out, I don't know. We'll find that out. But I do want to thank and make folks aware of the work that has been done. There has been a tremendous amount of planning done in recent years, and we stand much better prepared than we would have been 10 or 20 years ago.
Representative Dembro, and I see General Caldwell in the back. Did you come to share any information with us, General?
No, ma'am. I'm just here in case you had any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Something we haven't really talked about yet is the potential danger of overreacting or, you know, of misinformation. And, you know, when I first heard about the decision to close Western Oregon, I was thinking that that was really overreacting. But as you've walked us through, you know, the decision-making process, it seems very appropriate, very well thought out. But still, I do wonder if this is something that you think about. I have some concerns about some, you know, inappropriate conceptions about Oregonians with ties to Mexico, for example, or even, you know, that people may be thinking that there's a danger in swine, right, just because of that perhaps inappropriate label of swine flu. And so I'm wondering how your information campaigns and your contacts with your people on the ground are addressing this potential problem.
Chair Tomei, Representative Dembro, that is a... all of the points you made are right on target. We think a great deal about overreacting, and everything that we do or don't do has risks and benefits to it, and we are constantly trying to balance those. The reason it's such a challenge is that the information changes. I mean, I described to you all of the uncertainties around Western Oregon. Is this a confirmed case or not? Exactly how many contacts did this person have, and so forth. It's a real challenge to do that, but I think there is a potential for overreacting, and that is bad for people and undercuts our credibility. But at the same time, we need to be there to make sure we're doing everything we can to protect people from this illness. The issues about stigma and you know, all of those questions are also very, very important ones, both for the Mexican community, and I think it's very bad for public health for us to be using these kinds of events in any way that disrespects anybody. So we have tried to work very hard to do that. The issue about the label of swine flu, we struggled with that as well. And we have gotten a lot of questions. Is it okay to eat pork? Our response is usually, well, as far as swine flu is concerned, yes, you know, all of those other issues,
now let's talk about
we're not going to go there. We try to communicate that as best we can. If we don't use that label, our fear is, though, that people will not recognize what we're talking about, because that good or bad is the label that has sort of gotten out there. So we try to be sensitive to that and adjust as best we can. You know, this is it's an ongoing challenge for us in all those areas.
you. And if I could just follow up, you know, I think people often overreact out of a sense of panic and lack of awareness of just all the systems that are in place to protect them. So I think just, you know, getting out information about that, I think, will help.
Thank you, Representative. General Caldwell, we have about 8 minutes left. I'm going to ask you to come up. You've never been in our committee before. I think it's important to introduce yourself and tell us what you do, and we'll see if we have any questions. Representative Cowan.
While he's getting seated, could I let Dr. Cohn close with just one more piece that I don't think we've covered as well as I'd like to, and that is the antivirals, what they do, what they don't do, who should take them. Could you get that on from the health perspective on the record for us just a bit?
Representative May, Representative Cowan, absolutely. The antiviral drugs have, I think, a fairly limited but important use in the control of this outbreak, pandemic, if we get there. Many times we have flu viruses that evolve into resistant flu viruses. That means that these medications are not useful against them. And so part of the way to prevent that evolution of resistance is by using these judiciously when it's appropriate to do that. The places where fortunately, the current strain is sensitive to at least two of the antiviral medications that we have available. And we have, I think, an adequate supply here in Oregon together with the Strategic National Stockpile to do what we need to do around this outbreak. And that is, treat seriously ill people and, in certain outbreak situations, to protect people who might be particularly vulnerable. So, for example, if we had a confirmed case who had somebody who, let's say, was, undergoing chemotherapy for cancer, but had been exposed to this person, that would be someone we would probably want to put on antivirals to protect them. So what we don't want to have happen is have everybody on antivirals. First of all, it's not feasible to have our entire population on them. It's extremely expensive. There are side effects. This gets to the risk and benefit side of things. And it just doesn't make sense if we're in this situation for, well, let's say 6 or 8 months till we get some vaccine. So we're going to put people on this medication every day for 6 or 8 months. It's just not a good use of the limited resources we have. So we are not recommending that people go out and try to have some of this on hand. I don't think that's a good way for us to go. We need to have it when we need it. And other than that, it's not going to be a fruitful thing to do.
Thank you, Dr. Cohn. Let's move on. Thanks.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. So far, as was mentioned earlier, our role with emergency management, being a division of the military department, has been in support of the health division and in support of the DHS in any manner they may need at this point, which has been fairly limited at this point. But a good example of that support was, as the doctor mentioned, the National Strategic Stockpile. We worked with the health division and the ODOT to try to figure out where was the best place to put this, 153 pallets, I think it was, 154 pallets of goods, which is by itself a little bit daunting to try to find a place where you can, one, keep it secure, two, get in and get out with the right equipment to move it around if and when we need to move it. So we worked with the interagency to try to sort it out, figured out the best place to put it was with us, since we had 24/7 protection on it and ability to secure it in a good manner. So that's a good example of how we work in support of the organization. We're not to supplant them. We do have medical personnel in the National Guard that serve as part of our organization, and they could be called if the doctor or a local health department needed that ramp up in support. We would be able to do that as well. I will tell you that, as many of you are aware, if you're not all aware by now, that we're deploying to over 2,600 National Guardsmen deployment ceremonies this weekend and on Monday to go to Fort Stewart, Georgia to prepare to go to Iraq. They just left training down in California. We thought when we planned this was a good thing. Bring them home, have them home for a week, and then put them all back together and send them off to Fort Stewart. Since a week ago, we started rethinking that plan. Of course, it was too late to change it. We thought, well, we may have just not been the smartest move we ever made, was doing exactly that in case there's, of course, the opportunity to get them infected and then put them all back together. So we're concerned about that, and we've taken steps within the commands with the advice from the health division on those steps that every individual needs to take and what commanders need to take to make sure that everybody is doing everything we can to prevent, if in fact there is anybody that happens to get infected, that we can maintain it and, or control it and isolate it and keep it from infecting literally all of that battalion or brigade. To that, we actually went out and probably started a rush on it, but we bought lots of these. And we've handed them out to everybody. These are hand sanitizer. The first thing that occurred to us when we directed people to do it, they can do it at the local levels, we said, do not go in your uniform and buy these things in the local Payless, or we will have all kinds of panic. And so we directed people to do that in regular civilian clothes or work, you know, literally through the back door so it doesn't look like some guardsman in there with five shopping carts of this stuff emptying the shelves. And then the rest of the public suddenly goes, they know something, we don't. So we tried to do that in a very subtle manner, and I think we've got the job done, but we're going to make sure everybody's got these in their pockets and try to get them to use them just as well. So those are some of the little steps that we're doing, and we're really following the guideline of what Dr. Cohn and his colleagues are suggesting in the public health system. And then, of course, our medical personnel are tuned into it as well with respect to their contacts through the Department of Defense. So I'd say we're in pretty good shape right now. We've got certainly our hands full with getting these folks out the door, particularly our medical folks. So we're hoping that there isn't a need for our people, at least for another week, so we can get this group gone and then kind of get back to a normal rhythm. So beyond that, we're here to assist in any way we can, and we will continue to do that. Mr. Murphy mentioned earlier that his ECC is not stood up 24/7. Well, that's not quite accurate. We have a 24/7 operation in the Oregon National Guard, and everything that would go to that ECC in OEM also is logged in, and we have a 24/7 operation in our building down here on State Street the ARC, or the Anderson Readiness Center, and we monitor that. You know, like I said, 24/7 report comes out every morning of what activity may or may not have gone into OEM and or the Guard. So we keep a good watch on that too to make sure that we're tuned in and we're always talking with the governor and his staff. So I think the right people are at the right place at the right time. So we'll just hope that, as the doctor indicated, it doesn't go any further than that.
Thank you, General. Representative Cohen.
Madam Chair, I'm trying to help you wrap this up and to kind of give some previews to next week in Veterans and Emergency Services on Thursday. We'll be having some conversation about the deployment issues and the support system for the troops, and if necessary, we'll touch on some of these kinds of issues proves to have been important. And then as the situation evolves, and timing will depend on how things go, I guess. But I'm thinking perhaps a couple weeks hence, as part of emergency services, we might have carry on the other pieces of this conversation beyond the health aspects that we weren't able to get to in terms of what we are either needing at that point or debriefing on what we thought might have been a shortfall. I'm thinking around some economic issues that will be huge if we begin to need to shut certain facilities down, or if there's business impacts. There's a whole lot of things that go with, but our first concern is being healthy. And then as we think about some of the things that we might do around containment, those have economic fallout as well. And so I think there are other pieces of this conversation that time didn't allow us to touch on this morning, and we'll try to pick that up in a week or two as we see where things are heading.
Great. I appreciate that. Any last questions? Representative
Van Norman. I just have one last comment in reference to what Representative Dembro said. And it would be that there's a huge chasm between looking sheepish and being remorseful. And I think that, I think at least if it's sheepish, you can laugh about it later, but remorse will haunt us.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you all who came today, especially you, Dr. Cohn, and Ms. O'Leary, and Ms. Dimmert, and General Caldwell, all who came to learn about this issue. We want to learn more as time goes on, and I'm sure you'll be coming back to us to alerting us to any new issues that we should be concerned about and have hearings about. So again, thank you all. Thank you, committee.
Thank you.
And I'll see you on the floor.
Public hearing.